Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. Today, we'll learn about a new short film from Sesame Street that addresses parental drug and alcohol addiction, as described by 10-year-old Celia Woodbury, whose mom and dad went to rehab when she was little.
They were gone for 60 days, but it felt like 60 years.
In the video, Celia shares what it was like to have parents who struggle with addiction. Celia learned how journaling and meditation helped her when her parents were in recovery. She decided to teach meditation to other children.
Kids and their moms need time to breathe and relax because they're stressed and maybe having big feelings.
And we'll take a look inside West Virginia's foster care system, which is so overwhelmed, some children end up having to temporarily sleep in a hotel or in a state office on a cot or a blow-up mattress. Children facing tough odds this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd, guest hosting this week's episode. We usually bring you episodes with a running theme throughout the show. Today, we have a hodgepodge theme of sorts, with stories that show a range of struggles people are dealing with in our region and some of the solutions that might help. We'll hear what scientists think may be killing off apple trees. And we'll explore the research behind job creation programs, many of which are supported by federal grants. Do they actually work to bring long-term economic impact to Appalachia? But first, we're going to start on a pretty serious note. Many children whose parents struggle with drug addiction are facing a lot of tough realities. As a new mother myself, I find it heartbreaking that so many kids are not given the chance to do the most important work of just being a kid without worries. In many states, the opioid crisis is contributing to a surge in foster care cases. West Virginia has been hit especially hard. Child advocates are suing the state for allegedly failing to protect kids from abuse and neglect. I recently spent some time with some of the people who see firsthand how overwhelmed the state's foster care system is and how it's impacting children. Circuit Court Judge Joanna Tabbitt sits at her desk, taking notes in a yellow legal pad as she reviews a stack of about a dozen cases.
Every judge that you talk to in the state of West Virginia will tell you that their dockets are completely filled with abuse neglect cases.
Almost 9 out of every 10 of these cases involve a parent who struggles with addiction. As a judge, Tabbitt decides which children stay in foster care and which ones are reunited with their birth families. She says the ultimate goal is to get the kids back with their parents. But that only happens in about half of all cases.
The time frames are just too tight.
Usually, parents are given about a year to prove they are able to kick their addiction.
And you're not going to be able to get everyone into recovery and to get everyone where they need to be because most people do relapse. That's just part of the addiction process.
There are about 7,000 kids in foster care today in West Virginia. That's up almost 70% in 6 years. Spending has gone up, too. The state estimates the state and federal government will spend more than $330 million this year on child welfare services. Foster care is part of that.
We recognize we have a child welfare crisis in this state.
Bill Crouch is with the State Department of Health and Human Resources.
We have had to take children and keep them in overnight in a hotel or motel somewhere close.
Children sometimes stay in a hotel with a social worker, or even inside a state office, on a cot or a blow-up mattress. The first thing social workers do when a child needs to be removed from their home is to try to find a relative, like a grandparent. But if no relative will take them, they turn to a foster care agency, like the Children's Home Society in Charleston. On a Friday afternoon, the phones are ringing off the hook.
Happy Friday! This is Charlotte.
Charlotte Barnett is a social worker. On this day, Barnett and her staff are often scrambling in a frenzy, trying to find someone who will take a child, even just for the weekend. Every spare inch of their building is filled with piles of donated baby clothes, car seats, and toys. Barnett trains and oversees about 30 foster families in Kanawha County. And when Child Protective Services calls looking for a family, she's the one who picks up the phone day and night.
I'm sure that those workers have been working all day to try to find a home. It's heartbreaking.
On this day, a call comes in that a home is needed immediately for 3 children. siblings.
Yeah, right now I have no idea because everybody I have right now is totally full, so.
Barnett and the other social workers call every foster family on their list.
We got a slight situation here at the Charleston office and I need a little help.
By late afternoon on a Friday, a home is finally found for all three kids for one night. Then, the next morning, the social workers enlist a wider search across the state to find a home for the long term. This type of situation is common inside West Virginia's foster care system. These kids then have to deal with the emotional fallout that comes from the chaos. And the job of helping them work through that trauma often falls on the foster parents. So as we just heard, foster families are in high demand. West Virginia has the highest rate of children in foster care in the country. About 17 out of every 1,000 children here are in state care, according to a recent report by Child Trends. There are a lot of families who are stepping up to become foster families, but many say they feel unprepared for the looming task of taking care of the children who are placed in their homes. I went to meet some of them for our next story. Scott Tittle is cuddling with his 2-year-old adopted son on the couch. Scott's wife, Donna, sits down next to them and holds up a red and blue light-up toy. She presses the buttons and music plays. The toddler's face erupts in a smile, listening. Scott and Donna took their son home as a foster baby when he was just a few weeks old. It's not exactly what they thought they'd be doing at this stage in life.
I mean, we're 48 years old. We're close to 50. You know, most of the people I work with are thinking about retirement and empty nest and traveling.
Their toddler is doing well now, but he has had some health issues and developmental delays because of opioids he was exposed to before he was born.
It's hard to forget what's happened to him and what didn't need to happen to him.
Initially, they didn't think they were ready to foster a child with a disability. But Donna says they quickly grew attached.
I could not give him away. There was just no way. He was a part of this family, and no matter what obstacles come through our way, he's ours.
But they needed to learn how best to take care of a baby with neonatal abstinence syndrome, or the physical effects babies experience during withdrawal from drugs. In their training to become foster parents, the Tittles say they didn't get any preparation for how to take care of a baby with NAS. Another foster mom, Kelly Crow, recalls a similar experience, taking care of a baby girl with NAS. She remembers a lot of intense crying, which was scary. But ultimately, what the baby needed was pretty simple, around-the-clock cuddling.
The best thing that you can give them is, like, all the love that you have. So that means, like, physically, you know, all the touch that you can, all the soft voices that you can.
5 out of every 100 babies born in West Virginia have NAS. That's about 5 times the national rate. Many of these babies are put into foster care. Parents don't typically get any additional financial support unless the child's symptoms are severe or long-lasting. Marissa Sanders runs an advocacy group for foster families in West Virginia. She says those who need the most support are people who've taken in a grandchild or a neighbor, so-called kinship parents, representing about half of all foster homes.
Those people often don't get any training. They don't have the same level of support and, you know, background information and access to workers that a certified foster parent has.
Sanders wants the state to do more to help these grandparents learn how to cope with difficult behaviors.
When you're parenting a child who has experienced significant trauma, who is away from their birth family, who's, you know, in a difficult situation, there's a whole lot of extra support needed.
The state is trying to reduce the number of kids in foster care and save money. Jeremiah Samples is with the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources. He says the state needs to help more birth parents by connecting them with mental health care or parenting skills training. There are new funds available from the federal government to help. It's part of a new focus on keeping families together.
Once CPS goes out and a child has to be removed because of abuse and neglect, a trauma has already occurred. And so we need to prevent that to the extent that we possibly can.
fewer kids having to face the trauma of being uprooted from their parents, their schools, and their communities is clearly a win for all, especially children. If, and this is a big if, the state and the federal government can find an effective way to help parents make changes in their lives so the kids are safe. Kids whose parents struggle with addiction often don't get the chance to talk about what they're going through. And the stigma that follows people with addiction often has long-lasting impacts on the families. Could these children benefit from seeing stories of children who have gone through similar experiences? Last week, Sesame Street launched a new short film to help kids who are going through tough times when their parents are struggling with addiction. Sesame Street has a program called Sesame Street and Communities, which is provided to kids, teachers, and parents. It includes educational materials that cover issues like divorce, what happens when parents go to jail, or bereavement. Now, they also have a curriculum to help children whose parents are suffering from substance use disorder. There's a new Muppet called Carly. In the new 5-minute film, directed by Elaine McMillian Sheldon, Carly introduces us to a real-life girl, 10-year-old Celia. Let's listen to a bit of Celia's story.
When I was little, my mom and dad had to leave, and I had to stay with grandma and grandpa. My parents were struggling through a bad time with addiction. They had to go to a place to help them feel better. Addiction is a sickness. Addiction is getting too attracted to something, so you keep doing it over and over again. It makes people feel like they need drugs and alcohol to feel okay. And they can't stop doing it, and they aren't acting like themselves. They were gone for 60 days, but it felt like 60 years.
That was Celia, a girl who's featured in a new short film through Sesame Street. And with me in the studio is one of the filmmakers who worked on this film, Academy Award nominated Elaine McMillian Sheldon. Elaine, in that clip, we heard Celia talking about her parents' struggle, and I really love her definition. She's so articulate. Tell me, how did you all find Celia, and how did she work on that definition and her story and telling her story so beautifully?
So it was a challenge to find. There's plenty of families in recovery, but it was a challenge to find a family that had a kid that could really articulate what they had been going through. And we emailed a lot of people that had done community screenings for Heroin and Recovery Boys, our films about the opioid crisis, because we figured they might know of families, and had, you know, been looking for a family for a while. And I was giving a talk at a recovery conference, and at the end of that talk, I said, you know, if there's anyone here in this room that knows a family that might be interested in talking about their recovery process from the kid's perspective, which is a new way to think about it, please let me know. And that was in San Diego. And about 3 hours later, I got an email from Jaina Woodbury, who's Celia's mother, who sent me an interview that her and Celia had already done before in the past. They were, you know, Celia has been a big part of her mom and dad's recovery. She actually went to rehab with her mom, and she was little when it all started. And now,
what do you mean she went to rehab with her mom? Like, she attended the same?
Yeah, so there was a program in California that her mother went through after the first round of treatment. She went to this inpatient treatment where mothers could actually bring their children. And so Celia there learned a lot about what was going on. And the Woodberries are a great example of being transparent with your kids about what's going on, because I think a lot of kids are confused, and we think because they're children that they're not picking up on things, but they absorb everything. And without the proper context and language and understanding, they often can blame themselves, think that their actions caused the strife within the family. And it's important to have little girls like Celia really articulating addiction in a child-centric way, you know, thinking of addiction as something that you can't stop, you know, that it's a repeated action. And, you know, Sesame Street, I think, you know, they were on scene with us when we were doing the interviews with her, and they talked to her about what she thought addiction was and, you know, helped her sort of articulate what she ended up saying. And it's from her mouth, and it's brilliant. You know, we don't talk to kids enough, and who better to talk to kids than a 10-year-old kid?
As a storyteller, I always wrestle with how much of a child's story should we tell, especially for these things that have a stigma attached to them, like addiction. And what did you guys discuss with Sesame Street about,
using someone's face in this way, knowing that the story will follow them for decades.
Yeah. Well, I think that we chose a family that was very comfortable. It was their decision to be very forthright about their experience. And so that was first the point was to find a family that was comfortable with that. There's a difference between showing a child in a really vulnerable situation, like in the throes of something, whether that's, if we were filming a scene of, emergency scene of an overdose and showing a child in that scenario, I really struggle with that type of imagery because that is a very negative thing that's going to follow that child around and they didn't really have consent. Whereas with this is something of a teaching moment, a kid's opportunity to share their voice of hope. And I think for a story of hope to follow the family around gives them, more fuel for what they're doing and allows them to share their story and helps decrease stigma.
And when Celia's mom was in recovery, her mom taught her meditation. And Celia was inspired to teach meditation to others. Let's listen to a clip where she describes how that process really helped her through a tough time.
I would get really angry when I was younger. Whenever she taught me about meditation, I just knew that I should just breathe, and then it would be better. I started to teach kids meditation when Mom and me were at her treatment place. What meditation means to me is to be more peaceful and more aware of all your surroundings and to help you relax and be able to breathe. And the goal is to sit as still as a frog, like my frog assistant, Mr. Hopper. It feels good to help other kids who are going through what I went through. Take in another long breath, let it out slowly, and feel even calmer. Sitting still like my frog, Mr. Hopper. When you are ready, give yourself a big stretch and open your eyes. Kids and their moms need time to breathe and relax because they're stressed and maybe having big feelings.
I mean, what an important and true message for all kids and moms, whether or not they're going through addiction. Does Sesame Street have any plans to bring Celia's story to the broadcast program?
She went to New York. The family, the Woodbury family, was brought to New York to film some one-on-ones with Carly. And those are on the Sesame Street and Community's YouTube page. There's a ton of incredible resources on Sesame Street and Community's website and the YouTube page. And so she's with Carly. She teaches Carly how to meditate and how to breathe. And they're actually bilingual programs too, which is really incredible. But one of the things Sesame wanted to do was, in addition to showing things like breathing and meditating, which was passed from Jaina to Celia, also really tangible, easy things like teaching kids to journal about their feelings or teaching kids to be okay with those big feelings and teaching them that it's normal to have emotions and to feel sad and to feel happy. That's all part of being a child. And furthermore, it's all part of being an adult. And the adults that choose to numb those things and then no longer have that choice because they're addicted, numbing those emotions and the trauma and the pain is what we want to avoid kids to do in the future. So, kids are at such a higher risk if they're from a family that has addiction in the home, whether it's current or previous. And so it's really important to teach them resilience. And so things like art therapy and journaling and meditating and being a good sister or brother by helping out around the family so that kids don't blame themselves and so they understand their role within the family. I think a lot of people are torn. This is both a really happy day that Sesame Street has decided to, announce this new Muppet and have this incredible program. But it's also very heartbreaking that we are at this point in the country where this is needed. And I understand that. I understand that conflict. But I ultimately think, the situation is what it is and we can sit back and allow children to be confused and follow down the same path as their parents or we can give them tools to understand the situation and hopefully lead better lives, have different outcomes. And that's what's most important.
So let's end with one more quote from Celia sharing her brave story with us.
I'm proud of Mom and Dad for asking for help and not using drugs or alcohol anymore. And they're proud of me for just being me. Going through tough times is harder for families, but when they get to the end of it, they end up stronger.
That was 10-year-old Celia Woodbury telling her story in a short film that's part of the online series Sesame Street in Communities. We've posted that video on our website, along with another one, which is for caretakers and social workers. You can watch them both on wvpublic.org.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Now we're going to hear about an issue that is facing more and more families across our region, especially as so many people are impacted by economic hardship. The Charleston Gazette-Mail recently reported that 4% of all students in West Virginia are homeless, based on data from the State Department of Education. In one county, Jefferson, it's as high as 16% of students. We often think of homelessness as a problem in the big cities. In fact, it's everywhere. And in rural Appalachia, if you face homelessness, it can be challenging to find resources to help get back on your feet. And while we Appalachians pride ourselves on being supportive of our family and neighbors, like all people, we can turn a blind eye if someone is in need. A pastor in Kanawha County, West Virginia, in a small town called St. Albans, saw that a homeless encampment consisting of about 10 tents in his community was being pushed out. People were being told they had to leave. So he decided to help. But not everyone in the town approves of the work he's doing. Producer Kyle Vass spent some time this summer looking into what's been happening with the tent city.
They hate to move every night, and they hate to bother people.
Stan is a pastor here in St. Albans. He's driving around the outskirts of town, pointing out the tucked away thickets where homeless people have set up camps.
They're not trying to break into people's homes, or I'm not saying that some don't, but that the majority of them are just broken people that just want to be treated with a little respect and dignity and remain private, remain out of the public eye.
Stan knows these camps well because he takes care of people facing homelessness in and around St. Albans. This past summer, Stan heard the sheriff was going to shut down the largest of these camps, a place called Tent City. When Stan heard the news, he did something big. He purchased the land that the camp was on. The camp was on private property. Now that Stan owns it, he's legally allowed to let people stay on it without the fear of them being made to leave. But a lot of people in town aren't happy with what Stan's done.
They call it Tent City, but actually it looks like a lot of tarps and whatever these people can gather to put shelter over their heads. A lot of trash laying on the ground.
Rick Willis is the administrator of a Facebook group called St. Albans Taking Back Our Community. It has 4,500 members, a number that is nearly half the population of St. Albans.
The purpose is to return the community to its original glory. You didn't have homeless wandering the streets, breaking in people's houses, stealing everything that isn't nailed down.
Rick's group blames people like Stan who offer services to the homeless. They say these services are enabling homelessness.
You've got a church and a minister that bought a piece of property that set up a tent city for some of the homeless vagrants. Of course, you know, there's a lot of people supporting. There's a lot of people that are very angry about what he did. You know, it was done kind of in the dark. It was unpublicized, but, you know, and Albany is still a small town and word got around.
They took my picture, posted my address, posted my telephone number, posted my wife's business, posted her name, encouraged people to dump garbage at our house and at her business and at the church. And they did dump garbage at the church.
According to Stan, Whoever dumped the garbage on his church lawn did it as an act of revenge. He thinks their rationale goes something like this. You're enabling people who fill our city with garbage, so we're going to dump actual garbage on your property. See how you like it. But Stan points out that he didn't create this camp. In fact, it would have been impossible for him to have started this camp. According to local business owners, this tent city has been around for over 40 years. Stan has only been involved with this camp for about a year and a half. He saw something tragic, and he couldn't ignore it.
I was dumping trash at the dumpster behind the police barracks, and there was a lady feeding an 18-month-old baby out of a garbage bag that was in a dumpster, and it was pouring the rain, and the baby was picking up pasta off the plate as fast as she could put it in and putting it in its mouth. And I said, this can't be anymore. This is my problem. That's what opened my eyes. And then coming down here and seeing these people, they feel ashamed of where they are. I mean, I heard one of them tell me and the sheriff this spring, who would want to live like this? Who would want to live with the backwaters coming up to your tent door or with mosquitoes or bugs or poison ivy or in this situation? We'd rather have houses, but we're just not to that place. They've lost everything by either bad decisions or some other form of poverty that came to them. And are there people that have made major ugly mistakes? Sure. But we have too.
We mostly see homelessness as an issue facing people in cities, but it's a very real issue in rural areas. Being homeless out here presents a unique set of challenges.
One would definitely be simply the fact of transportation and distance.
That's Dr. Sydney McElroy. She's a family medicine doctor in Huntington and host of the medical podcast Sawbones. Dr. McElroy says that outreach obstacles present a huge health risk for people facing homelessness.
It's a lot harder if you are experiencing homelessness in a rural area, depending on where you are, to get to the services and places. I think about a lot when we discharge people from the hospital, we'll tell them to call. Well, if you don't have a place that you're always going back to, if your home moves about and you don't have a phone number, that's impossible. We have now created a situation that is impossible for you to solve.
Living in a community helps people overcome these obstacles. You don't have a phone, maybe a neighbor can lend you theirs. And Dr. McElroy says the benefits of having a community go beyond being able to share stuff.
The other thing I would bring up is that in every study of life expectancy, one of the things that correlates best with a longer life expectancy is social connection. The more connected you are to other humans and to a community of people, the longer you live, it improves your health outcomes to have connections.
Social connections. When I asked residents about living in this camp, they didn't bring up the flooding, extreme temperatures, mosquitoes. They chose to talk about how grateful they are. Grateful to have one another, to have Stan, to have a place to sleep at night. This is Wallace, one of the residents. He's from nearby Alum Creek.
The people here in this area here where the tents and stuff are, for the most part, all of them get along real good together and make you feel real welcome here. When I was told that I could move into this area here, and that really did mean a lot to me, because you go in certain areas, if you try to pitch a tent or if you just try to lay down alongside the road there, I mean, the police have to do their job there. And I mean, most of the time you can tell that they really don't like running you off of here, running you off from there. It's just a thought there that you know for sure that you're really not allowed to be there. But I mean, it's really nice there that you can come here and get a tent and not have to worry about anybody coming along and telling you that you gotta leave or anything like that.
Another resident, Jamie, is incredibly grateful for Stan and his church.
Who would come in a pouring storm, and I mean pouring like buckets of rain that was freezing, to the middle of the woods to a tent to bring a stranger kerosene just to make sure they're not freezing?
Jamie points out that in the arguments over camps like these, people often forget that each person facing homelessness has a story where tragic circumstances have led them to places like this tent city.
When you're homeless, you lose so much. You lose your dignity. I worked my whole life. I always had a home, and because of domestic violence, I lost my home, I lost my property, like that. And I met a lot of terrible people. It seems like when you're down, that's when people are, they're at their worst. And then along comes Dan and his wife, and, you know, it was just like God saying, hey, you know, I'm still here with you. He has done things for me that my own family didn't do, you know, that I felt really alone. I felt forgotten. I felt dismissed. And this perfect stranger came from out of nowhere. Him, his wife, the people that he worships with came and they changed my life.
Stan remembers the first night he came down here.
Somebody mentioned that there were a few people that stayed over here. So one Sunday night at about 7 o'clock, I walked the railroad tracks, and I said, I've got chili and blankets, and all these lights came on down here like fireflies. They came up, and they said, you're the first person to treat us like a human in years. And they began to weep.
He comes down here 3 times a week or more. Tonight, he's giving out pizza. He'd eventually like to move his church closer to Tent City when he has the funds. But until then, he's going to keep doing what he can.
Well, I think we have to actively get involved, and that requires us getting down and dirty. It means getting our hands dirty in situations that we don't want to be involved in, because we want to live as Americans in a world that doesn't have these problems. They're all third world countries, you know, that have these types of problems. But that's not true. I don't want to see these people live like this all their lives. I don't want to see anybody live like this. But we got to start where people are. We can't start where we want them to be. The reality is they're here. And what do we do to help them transition from here back into culture?
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Vass.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing some tough stories about real issues facing families and children across our region. Many of the people who end up homeless were living in a home, paycheck to paycheck, until hard times came their way. A job layoff, a car breaking down. These things, which could happen to anyone, can affect people in big ways. And although some people in Appalachia are doing well, I mean, we even have millionaires and billionaires here. There's a lot of economic instability across our region. Finding long-lasting solutions to create jobs in Appalachia isn't easy. And there are some programs trying to help, but are they really working? Some say we need investors to bring more industries. Others say we should be investing in our own entrepreneurs who can create homegrown businesses. But most economists say it will likely take many different approaches, working in tandem, if we're going to make any real progress. The U.S. Department of Labor recently announced nearly $5 million for worker training programs in Appalachia. It's the latest influx of funding aimed at blunting the job losses in the region's coal sector. But critics of the program say worker training alone is no solution. Becca Schimmel reports.
Bobby Bowman mined coal in West Virginia for 12 years before his employer shut down.
And I don't think that mine will ever open again.
Bowman decided to do a 4-week training program offered by the United Mine Workers Career Center. He enjoyed it and earned a certification in heavy equipment operation, but when he came back home, he struggled to find a job in the field. So Bowman took matters into his own hands.
So I sent myself through truck driving school. And that's what I'm doing today.
Bowman is not alone. Amid coal's decline, politicians are betting big on job training, with millions directed at those who lost jobs in mining and at power plants. But such retraining programs have a poor record in actually connecting dislocated workers with local employment that pays a comparative wage. Ted Bettner is the executive director of the left-leaning West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. He says job training hasn't made up for the number of jobs lost by the coal industry.
And there's great examples of ones here in Appalachia who have trained people for jobs, and then they could not find employment. And you have to realize, too, that a lot of this is in the backdrop of 40 years of wage stagnation across this country, and especially men in West Virginia.
He says job training needs to be connected to employment that pays well, because it's difficult to go from a $75,000 a year coal mining job to one that pays $12 or $15 an hour. In Kentucky, where miners have been hurt by recent coal bankruptcies, Josh Benton is the Deputy Secretary of the state's Education and Workforce Development Cabinet. Benton says the state has had some success retraining people to work in the healthcare industry, but the real challenge is finding jobs where that displaced worker lives.
And, you know, the challenge that we face is not necessarily, are the training programs effective? It is, are there other industries for those displaced workers to go to work?
Benton says the jobs that have been created in technology or healthcare don't make up for the ones lost in the energy sector over the last 10 years. Gordon Lafer is a professor at the University of Oregon who has written about the failures of job training programs. He says job training is a popular talking point for politicians.
And so I think that job training keeps being promoted because it solves a political problem, both for elected officials and for employers, but it doesn't do anything for the economics.
Lafer says the employment picture in the Ohio Valley is especially important because of its connection to climate change. He says talk of a Green New Deal and a move away from polluting industries should include a just transition for those who would lose jobs.
You know, it's just not in good faith to say one group of people is going to pay the price for saving the planet.
Lafer says one way to do that is to train people and invest in the industries that can't move to a different country with cheaper labor. Some of those industries include healthcare, construction, education, and tourism. Economist Ted Bettner says infrastructure investments could help create a stable economy that works for everyone.
Have we upgraded our antiquated grid? That's thousands and thousands of jobs in West Virginia if we just upgrade the grid.
As automation continues to grow and the coal industry declines, more people will be displaced. The challenge is training those workers for jobs that pay well and aren't likely to be outsourced or automated. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
One way people are looking to boost our economy is through tourism. Of course, tourism doesn't create the same high-paying jobs that coal does, but it is a multi-billion dollar industry. Other countries have been able to leverage their wild places as destinations for nature lovers. Some people have wondered, could Appalachia benefit from a similar approach? After all, we have a lot of forests for hiking, rivers for kayaking and canoeing. But how to attract people? Brittany Patterson takes us to a community in Southwest Virginia that is using a local legend to help appeal to national tourists.
Just a few miles from the brick building lined streets of downtown Norton lies a city-owned 1,000-acre outdoor recreation paradise.
So we are now entering the Flag Rock Recreation Area.
Fred Ramey is Norton City Manager. Inside the park, there are signs that read, Trail Crossing, Official Wood Booger Sanctuary.
Wood booger.
You want the real story? Now, the wood booger came about actually unexpectedly.
A local legend about a Bigfoot-style creature got national exposure.
On this episode of Finding Bigfoot, the team from the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization heads to Southwest Virginia to investigate a Bigfoot sighting.
After this Animal Planet show aired in 2012, new visitors came to Norton searching for the legendary animal locals now call the wood booger.
It's been good for business.
Steve Jesse works at Home Hardware and Furniture in downtown Norton, which sells t-shirts with the wood booger's likeness. The city created the Wood Booger Sanctuary, and it even spawned a festival in October that draws hundreds of people.
People just have a lot of fun with it.
Ramey says the town has something a lot more solid than a mythical mountain creature. Norton is betting on the very real value of the mountains around them. For decades, coal was king here. But since 2008, Virginia's coal production has fallen by about half.
In a certain way, our community has found itself at another intersection. And due to the loss of coal, and that's when we had to really start thinking differently.
The city already has a service-based economy. Things like hotels, restaurants, good roads are already here. So tourism made a lot of sense.
It just made common sense to us that we ought to look at expanding our potential in tourism.
But becoming a tourist mecca doesn't happen overnight. The city has invested in 8 miles of mountain bike trails, with more going in every day.
When you have mountain bikers come to your town, they're going to come out of the woods and come down and frequent your restaurants.
Shane Fields is the trail coordinator for Norton and an avid cyclist.
You'll have patronage at your restaurants, your hotels, any little shops you have in town.
Mark Haggerty with the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics says several communities have had success making this transition from coal to outdoor recreation. But he warns outdoor recreation by itself is no silver bullet.
Recreation is really a means to an end. So what a recreation strategy does for you is it makes your community more attractive, and it has to be set within a broader economic development strategy.
Walking the trails in Flag Rock Recreation Area, Fred Ramey says he agrees.
We're not saying that tourism is going to be our answer, but we believe it can be part of the solution.
While numbers are hard to come by, Ramey says judging by license plates from Florida and North Carolina in the parking lot on this random weekday, it does seem to be working. And if one of them finds the wood booger, all the better.
We've got a friend that believes in Bigfoots and
all
stuff.
Right. We're going through with you.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson in Norton, Virginia. Next, we're going to look at two industries that are facing some big threats and how scientists hope to find answers that can help. Half the land area of Pennsylvania and the eastern panhandle of West Virginia drains into the Chesapeake Bay, and that includes a lot of pollution, mostly from agricultural runoff and sewage overflows. Recently, Pennsylvania has come under fire from Maryland's governor for not investing enough money to help clean up the bay. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Kara Hall-Sopple reports a handful of Pittsburgh residents have joined a recycling effort to improve water quality in the bay using oyster shells.
Jessica Lewis says shucking an oyster is like picking a lock.
You press down and then you just wiggle, pop it open. The abductor muscle right there, you clean that.
Lewis is the executive chef of Spirits and Tails at the Oaklander Hotel in Pittsburgh. She runs a small knife around the sides of a closed oyster shell.
You can't really muscle through it. You clean under it and see all that liquor? This one's got a lot of liquor in it.
That's the salty ocean water still inside the shell, and it makes the oyster slide out smoothly into your mouth.
That's perfect. I'm gonna take this one right here.
Lewis says they go through about 300 to 400 oysters here a week from the east and west coasts. This oyster is from Maryland's Chesapeake Bay, and its top and bottom shell are going back there. Lewis and her staff toss the spent shells in a 35-gallon barrel with a screw-on lid. It's located in the trash area on the ground floor of the building.
So nobody likes to recycle the oyster shells because there's flies everywhere and it's nasty. Gross. So we're doing something good. Let's get out of here.
About once a month, a truck picks up the old shells from this and six other participating restaurants in Pittsburgh and drives them more than 250 miles to a staging area just across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in Maryland. From there, the oyster shells from Pittsburgh and ones collected from Maryland, Virginia, and the D.C. area are taken to a site at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Laboratory in Cambridge for processing.
So here you're looking at about 7,000 tons of clean shell.
Karis King is with Oyster Recovery Partnership, a nonprofit which works to increase oyster numbers in the Chesapeake Bay. We're standing at the base of a mountain of gray shells. They've been dumped into a machine that's like a modified potato hopper, which sorts the shells, and washed with water from the nearby Choptank River, a major tributary of the bay. Smaller fragments of broken shell fall away as a conveyor belt deposits the half shells into wire cages or piles, where they're cured for a year. Then they're ready to go on to the next phase of the recycling chain.
Even with, you know, all of the shell that we do recycle and that we also purchase some from shucking houses, we still don't have enough to do large-scale restoration at the rate that we could.
That's because of the scale of the problem. Stephanie Alexander manages the Horn Point Lab oyster hatchery.
When John Smith sailed up in the 1600s, he was running aground on the oysters.
Alexander says that's before these waters were over-harvested, before there was agricultural runoff and soil erosion from development.
We've pretty much wiped the oyster out to less than 1% of historic levels. So we started this restoration effort where we're using a hatchery to produce spat on shell to put back into the bay so we can kind of help jumpstart Mother Nature.
The concept is pretty simple. Scientists here at the lab produce baby oysters from adults harvested from the bay, nurture the microscopic larvae with a custom algae diet, then get them to attach to the recycled treated oyster shells. That's the spat on shell. In practice, it's a lot harder than it sounds. Ben Malmgren is an intern here, a student from St. Mary's College of Maryland.
Right now, we're placing the oysters out on the spawning table where we are going to simulate river conditions that are ideal for spawning.
The saltiness and temperature of the water in the shallow black basins has to be just right. Malmgren places the oysters in a grid formation, so it's easier to separate the males from the females.
Because if we just let them spawn out on the table, all these eggs are going to go down to the into the drain. So once we see a female, and we'll know she's a female by she'll clap her top and bottom shell together, and it'll see a plume of eggs come out. It'll kind of look like Splenda, like in a cup of coffee.
Then he'll pull the females off the table, where they'll continue to spawn in a tub. Those eggs will be fertilized with the sperm collected from the male oysters. But the oysters aren't cooperating today. Left to their own devices, it could take hours.
It's a lot like just watching a pile of rocks, but it can be exciting when they all start going.
Even in the lab, nature is in charge. Stephanie Alexander says it was a slow summer. A lot of rain meant the adult oysters have lived with lower salinity levels, and they're stressed. Out in the bay, the water is warmer, meaning the spat on shell might have a harder time growing that second shell, and over the years, forming the clusters that create oyster reefs.
When one thing gets out of whack, everything else is going to kind of follow. So we're trying to get the oysters back into balance, so then hopefully everything else will follow as well.
Over the last two decades, the lab and Oyster Recovery Partnership have planted over 8 billion oysters on the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, with the help of other partners like the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Throughout the summer, spat on shell are released from a boat on sites where they're most likely to survive. And Alexander says that's critical.
Oysters are the vacuum cleaners or the kidneys of the bay, and they just suck the water in. They decide if it's food or not food, but no matter what it is, they'll remove it from the water column, and that's how they vacuum the bay up and clean it.
Because of this superpower, oyster aquaculture is a best management practice, identified by the regional partnership that oversees cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. Some of the spat raised at the Horn Point Lab will make its way to oyster farmers, and those are the oysters on a half shell that are served in restaurants. But the majority of the spat will help rebuild oyster reefs, creating habitat for fish and restoring the ecosystem. Back in Pittsburgh, Jessica Lewis is educating diners and trying to convince other Pittsburgh restaurants to join the oyster shell recycling effort that feeds the conservation work, to see the value in giving back.
With all this like climate change going on and all the scary things, it's like a bright light shining through and that we did something good.
Her pitch, every shell counts. Kara Holsapel, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
That sounds like an important and tasty program in northern Appalachia. We can only hope that scientists can help find a solution to the problem that is cropping up in our next story. For the past several years, my husband and I have a fall tradition of picking apples to make into cider. This year, we have a new baby, so we've only managed to pick a few crates of apples. But it was so fun to set her down on the ground and hold an apple while she watched us work. I really hope the apple trees here in West Virginia stay healthy, especially with news that farmers are losing their apple trees in parts of Pennsylvania, New York, and North Carolina. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports researchers call it rapid apple decline and are trying to figure out what's causing it.
Noah Petronic is worried about his apple trees. He's orchard manager at Sorgel Orchards in Wexford, just off the highway north of Pittsburgh. We start walking down a row of Braeburns. Most of the trees look healthy, with green leaves and bountiful pink fruit. But a couple have taken on a strange, rusty hue and are clearly struggling.
You can just see the first two trees you hit right here have shut down just over the past few weeks. We can walk through it here and I can point out about another five or six that are shutting down.
Petronik says he started noticing this around 2013.
You have beautiful crop on, you know, especially August, September, your apples are starting putting on color, size, especially your later varieties like Fuji and Braeburn and Johnnigold. And then all of a sudden you come back a week later and it would be dead.
Apple trees are actually made up of two parts that are grafted together. Growers choose a type of rootstock based on the soil or size of the trees they want, and then graft the apple varieties, the Braeburn or Golden Delicious, onto it. Petronik scrapes his boot along the bark of a dying tree just above the root.
You can see where the graft union is down there. That's just totally necrotic. It's rotting away. Looks like
you're using necrotic.
Necrotic. If we would peel it away, actually, you could actually see the rot.
That rot at the graft is the telltale sign of rapid apple decline.
This year, it's been horrible.
Carrie Peters is an associate research professor at Penn State's Fruit Research and Extension Center in Adams County. 70% of the state's apples are grown there. Peters has heard from around 50 Pennsylvania apple growers this year.
I've been so overwhelmed in 2019 by reports of massive tree die-off that it's been difficult to keep up.
Peters has been trying to get to the bottom of it. She and other researchers have looked at common apple problems like soil pathogens, viruses, and even rodents.
And everything came back negative. But the common thread with these declining or dead trees is that the collapse is at the graft union. The roots were perfectly healthy, and the graft union was dying.
What researchers think they've learned so far, this is not an insect or a disease that spreads from tree to tree. A study by Cornell University published this year found that weather-related stress like drought and severe colds could be an underlying cause. But Peters doesn't think that's the whole story. She has other theories, including increased rainfall or certain herbicides. She says a variety of stressors could be working together to lead to rapid apple decline.
We just don't know.
Back at Sorgel Orchards, Noah Petronik shows me a new variety he just planted, Crimson Crisp, and then some 40-year-old stamen winesap trees. He takes a bite of the vintage variety.
It's just baffling. It's heartbreaking, really, because you're taking care of these trees, you know, for years and years, and all the care that you can give the tree, you know, and all of a sudden it just, you know, doesn't make it.
Petronik says farming isn't getting any easier, but to continue growing local produce for customers, orchards like his will have to learn to adapt to rapid apple decline. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
I'm glad to know that scientists are looking into this. I mean, can you imagine fall without apple cider or apple pie? On our website, we've posted more stories about apple farming, cider making, and a recipe for apple pie. There, you can also subscribe to our Inside Appalachia newsletter to catch what we're up to and what we're working on next. We have a special new episode devoted to Halloween legends and ghost tales next week. Jessica Lilly will be back in a couple of weeks. Until next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, WKU, and the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackfort, Michael Howard, and Dinosaur Burps. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Brittany Patterson edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. I'm Roxy Todd. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.